From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, the story of the colorblind artist and the man whose vision was restored after 40 years. We talk with neurologist Oliver Sacks about the people with unusual neurological disorders, who he profiled in his recent book, An Anthropologist on Mars. The title comes from Temple Grandin's description of how she feels as an autistic person trying to function in the world. Grandin is one of the people Sacks profiled. In spite of her autism, she's a highly skilled designer of humane livestock holding pens. We'll talk with her about her autism. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Neurologist Oliver Sacks studies disorders of the brain to understand more about how the human brain works and what makes us human. His patients have disorders like Tourette's syndrome, autism, and amnesia. He's discovered that neurological problems often have the paradoxical role of bringing out latent creative powers. He writes, "The study of disease demands the study of identity, the inner worlds that patients under the spur of illness create." Dr. Sacks is best known for his books that describe those inner worlds through case studies, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat and Awakenings, which was adapted into a film starring Robin Williams as Dr. Sacks. One of the patients Dr. Sacks wrote about in his latest book, An Anthropologist on Mars, is an artist who became colorblind after an auto accident. Dr. Sacks calls him Jonathan I.
He was driving to a studio the day after the accident, and everything looked gray and bleached. Although he knew that it was a bright, sunny day, and when he got there, his paintings, which were brilliantly coloured, he was an abstract expressionist who was really famous for his use of colour, were all sort of drained of colour and in a sense of meaning and feeling for him. And he was aghast, and he went home, and his wife was a sort of an animated grey statue, as he described it, and he himself was grey, and the notion of grey flesh, touching grey flesh, sort of horrified him. And memory and imagination didn't help, as happens in this sort of situation when the colour-constructing parts of the brain are knocked out. You not only lose the ability to perceive colour, but to imagine it or remember it. Sort of the neural idea of colour is deleted. And this was a terrible time for him at first, because he found himself in a very ugly, impoverished world, and one which was sort of drained of meaning.
You know what I found? That losing his sense of color affected every aspect of his life. It affected what he wanted to eat. You say he only wanted to eat black and white foods, like yogurt or rice or black olives.
Right. Well, anything else just looked terribly wrong for him. And it's his dog looked terribly wrong, and he wanted to get a black and white dog.
I think what helped me get a sense of what he was going through was a painting of his that you reproduce in the book, and it's a still life of apples, oranges, bananas, but it's all in blacks and grays, with the exception of one orange that has its true color in the center of the painting. And the black banana is grotesque, it's nauseating.
Well, this was certainly how he found it. These fruits which he made were actually part of a whole grey universe which he made in his studio. It was a sort of a room with a banqueting table and a dinner laid out, and to try and show us what it was like. One of the things which had vexed him was people said, "Well, so you don't see colour, no big deal, what the hell?" You know, And it was in a way to try and convey the enormity of it that these sort of gruesome artifacts were produced.
What's so surprising about this story is that slowly his experience was redefined. What started off being really grotesque and nauseating to him became more natural.
Well, indeed, this was very remarkable. When he came to see me, I first sort of tried to define the damage as much as I could, and it was clear that there were two small areas in the back of the brain and the visual cortex which had been knocked out, areas which are sometimes called the colour-constructing areas. I didn't know whether they would ever recover, and I hoped he might sort of start to feel less horrified by this world. But as you say, in fact, the opposite happened, and gradually what had been so horrible took on a sort of beauty for him, and he reconstituted his world, or his world reconstituted itself in black and white, but again with the meaning and the feeling and the coherence and the artistic possibilities restored to it. And he started painting again, and people remarked on, you know, on the extraordinary power of this new black and white art. Very few of them knew that there'd been a neurological accident behind it. But it's this moving, losing one world, but then being able to recreate the world and oneself and in other terms, which was so striking with him, and in a sense, I suppose, becomes one of the themes of the book.
When you stopped seeing him, where did you leave things with him in terms of your diagnosis and prognosis?
Well, in terms of the diagnosis, I said he had knocked out these two small areas, which are called V4 in the brain, probably from a vascular accident, and I doubted if there would be any recovery. By that time, he had been launched on his art and again on his life, and didn't seem to be repining too much and no longer seemed to be yearning too much for colour. In the early days, he had, you know, he would glare at oranges and trying to restore them to their, in imagination, to their proper colour. And now he seemed very much at home, and even, I think, felt that he was in a rather privileged world of subtle tone and texture, and that the rest of us were sort of subject to sort of a chromatic distractedness. And there was one point when a colleague of mine thought of a way by which it might have been possible to reprogram other parts of the brain to construct colour. And at that point he said, I would have loved you if you could have done this earlier, but now, he said, I don't want it anymore. My world is complete without colour.
There's a story that's a really, really fascinating counterpart to the story of the artist who was colorblind. And this is the story of a man who was blind for 45 years, and then his sight was restored. And he had incredible difficulties adapting to having his sight.
Yes, this was Virgil. And I first learned of him, you know. Many of the stories, cases here, have started with a letter or a phone call, out of the blue. And here the phone call was saying, this man, blind since infancy, had surgery and his sight was restored, and now he sees everything, but he recognizes nothing. And, hell, what's going on?
What was going on? Is that typical, that if somebody has a sense restored or given to them for the first time in their life, that they can't make anything coherent out of it?
Well, I think this is typical, and I think perhaps it might have been anticipated. But this is a very rare situation. There have really been no more than perhaps 15 or 20 such cases described since the early 18th century, although interestingly, precisely this was described in 1728 in a blind boy from whom the cataracts were couched. But the immediate notion, and the notion you have in the Bible and in fairy stories, is that vision will be restored. And it was thought here that Virgil would have the operation. It might fail completely, but it might work, and he would say, you know, hallelujah, I can see again. And what happened wasn't at all like that. When the bandages were unwound, he saw a blur of movement and colour, which was chaotic, which made no sense. And it was only when his surgeon spoke that he thought to himself, voices come from faces, that blur must be a face. But it wasn't a coherent percept for him. He had no visual concept of a face. And this was his introduction, really, to a world of deep chaos in some ways, and the chaos of a man and a brain which hadn't learnt to see, which didn't know how to deal with this new input from the eyes.
So instead of the fairy tale happy ending where he shouts, "Hallelujah, my sight is restored," was he sorry that he had his sight restored?
Well, it was complex and mixed, because there were also some positive experiences. He was in fact delighted by movement and by colour, and he started to recognise various things. And it was certainly an adventure for him, but it was also a terrible challenge and stress, and one which I think was too much for him, and so increasingly he would often close his eyes or turn off the light and long for this secure world of touch and the other senses in which he felt at home.
This story has a very unusual twist to it. He ended up losing his sight again. What happened?
Well, in a way which I think might have was sort of a bit uncanny. And it happened soon, you know, at a time when he seemed to be turning a corner and really beginning to get used to the world of sight. He developed a bad pneumonia and almost died. This knocked out the respiratory center in his brain, and so the levels of oxygen in his blood fell very low. When they fell low, he would become completely blind again, and then he would recover some sight as the levels went up. But then, with this situation continuing, what sight he had and the visual world which he had achieved sort of disappeared again, and he once again became blind, and completely blind, and in a way blinder than he had ever been before, because his retina, in effect, got destroyed. And what exactly happened, I don't know, but I would suspect that these very abnormal blood gases must have played a part. It was an uncanny twist, but one which his wife and doctor, some people saw with horror. He himself, I think, was not entirely horrified, and it may have sort of released him from an impossible fight. I have to say that since then he has lost a good deal of weight and he is no longer on oxygen, and I'm told there is some sight again, and I have to see him, and there may be a postscript to this piece sooner or later.
Yeah, you also write that disorders and disease can play a paradoxical role by bringing out latent powers and creative potential. I guess that relates in a way to Jonathan Eye, the artist who became colorblind and started to work with that and do paintings that were acclaimed.
Yes, well, his sort of creative powers were there, but they were able to sort of flow into a new channel. But sometimes I think that an affliction alone can bring out something quite unexpected. I see this in many different ways. Something I didn't describe in the book, but it just comes into my mind. I have a patient, a very nice woman, who became quadriplegic in an accident, but now every morning she is able to look at the New York, the Times crossword, to consign the entire crossword to memory and then solve it mentally in the course of the day. She said she could never have done this before she became ill, but this sort of strange power just came to her.
Neurologist Oliver Sacks, recorded in February of 1995. One of the people he profiled in his bestseller, An Anthropologist on Mars, is an autistic woman named Temple Grandin. We'll hear from her in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Temple Grandin is an autistic woman. Neurologist Oliver Sacks, who profiled her in his book An Anthropologist on Mars, described her as one of the most remarkable autistic people of all. In spite of her autism, she holds a PhD in animal science, teaches at Colorado State University, and runs her own business. She's worked for many livestock companies designing humane restraining systems for handling cattle and hogs on ranches and during veterinary procedures and slaughter. One-third of the cattle and hogs in the United States are handled in equipment she designed. To make her achievements even more extraordinary, she's written her second book called Thinking in Pictures and Other Reports from My Life with Autism. Autism is a condition of aloneness. Most autistics shut out anything from the outside and insist on sameness and repetition in all their movements. Dr. Sacks says Grandin's story shows there are forms of autism which don't incapacitate in the expected ways. Grandin owes much of her success to her ability to think in pictures.
I think totally visually. All of my thoughts are like videotapes playing on a VCR in my head. When I design livestock handling equipment, I can test run the system in my head. It was easy for me to figure out how animals think and how animals would react because I think visually. Animals don't think in language, they think in pictures. It's very easy for me to imagine what would it be like to go through a system if you really were a cow, not a person in a cow costume, but really were a cow. And autistic senses and emotions are more like the senses of an animal. My nervous system was hypervigilant. Any little thing out of place, like a water stain on the ceiling, would set off a panic reaction. And cattle are scared of the same thing. They're scared of things like high-pitched noise, sudden clanging and banging, sudden movement, maybe even a little chain that hangs down in the chute and jiggles because it looks out of place. And things that are out of place can mean danger out in the wild.
So you think that being autistic has enabled you to understand cattle better?
I think it has because the way I think and feel is more like how animals think and feel. You know, very sensitive to any little change.
No, like most autistic people, you don't really like to be hugged or touched by other people. But you found a way of getting that comforting, secure feeling from a machine that you designed.
That's right.
You call it a squeeze machine. Some people have called it a hug machine. Would you describe what the machine does?
Well, I can get in it, and it's made with a foam rubber padded sides on it, and I can apply pressure to myself. See, when I was a little kid, I wanted to feel a nice feeling of being hugged, but the stimulation was too overwhelming. My overly sensitive nervous system just couldn't tolerate it. You know, I got an engulfing tidal wave of stimulation just pouring over me. And when I got into puberty, I started having horrible anxiety attacks, and I found that pressure calmed it. So I built this device I could get into that would apply pressure that would calm down my nervous system. Many autistic children seek pressure. They'll get under mattresses. They'll get under sofa cushions. And at first, I would tend to just pull away from the device. But then gradually, I got to where I could tolerate more and more, you know, being touched. And now I'm, you know, much more desensitized and can tolerate it.
So how often do you use that machine now?
Oh, I will, sometimes once a week. Now that I'm traveling on the road, I hardly ever get a chance to use it.
So how does it make you feel when you use it?
Well, it makes me feel very relaxed. It makes me feel gentler. I think that, you know, little babies need to feel the feeling of being held in order to, you know, develop empathy. I found that my empathy with the cattle got much deeper when I actually started touching the animals. I found when I touched the animals, you know, I could calm them down.
If somebody were to hug you now, would you feel as overwhelmed and uncomfortable and afraid as you did when you were young.
Oh, no. Now I actually like it when people hug me. Sensory oversensitivities can be desensitized. There are a lot of little autistic kids that pull away and they don't want to be touched. But then you gradually work on touching them. It's sort of like taming a wild animal. At first, the wild animal pulls away. But then after you work on touching it, then a stimulus that was at first overwhelming becomes something that the animal will like. And firm touch is calming, and very light touch sets off a fear reaction. Also, steady pressure is calming, and sudden jerky motion causes agitation and excitement. And the same thing's true with animals, because I've designed a lot of systems for holding animals. In fact, 1/3 of all the cattle in this country, when they go to a meat processing plant, are held in a device I designed. And I found that you have to have just the right amount of pressure. You hold the animal too tight, it hurts and he fights it. If you don't hold him tight enough, he doesn't feel held and he fights it. There's an optimal amount of pressure. Also, slow, steady pressure is calming. And if you do it too quickly, the animal will get excited.
Is the hug machine that you created for yourself based on cattle restraint devices that you had seen?
Well, yes, because when I was 18 years old, I had a constant state of anxiety all the time. It was like panic attacks. I felt like first radio interview nerves all the time for absolutely no reason. You know, I was in complete nervous system flight, you know, as if a lion was stalking around, you know, ready to get me. And I was desperate to get relief. And I watched when the cattle went in the squeeze chute to hold them for their vaccinations. Some of the animals would sort of just relax. So then I talked my aunt into letting me try it. And for about an hour afterwards, I was a lot calmer. In fact, pressure is used by a lot of therapists with autistic children. They'll roll them up in mats, they'll get them under beanbag chairs, and it helps to relax them and calm down the nervous system so it's easier to work on things like learning how to talk.
So your aunt had a cattle ranch?
Yes, she did.
So after you realized how comforting the pressure of this restraining device could be, did that lead you to want to work with animals?
Well, that's one of the things that got me interested, because I started going out to the feed yards and watching how the cattle reacted. And then this was about 20 years ago, and so I wanted to learn more about how the cattle reacted to things, so I got down into the chutes with my camera and took pictures through the chutes to get a cow's eye view. In fact, that was going to be the original title for my book, but somebody in the marketing department didn't like it very much. And got down there and looked through the chutes, and I began to see the sort of things that would bother the cattle: a shadow, a little thread out of place, any little thing, a coat or hat hanging on the fence, and see the things that would make them balk.
Temple Grandin. We'll talk more about her life with autism in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Coming up, we continue our talk with Temple Grandin about her life with autism and about her work as a successful designer of humane restraining equipment for cattle. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Temple Grandin. She's an autistic woman who, in spite of her autism, is a successful designer of restraining systems for livestock. Neurologist Oliver Sacks profiled her in his book An Anthropologist on Mars. She tells her own story in her memoir, Thinking in Pictures. Well, you've really devoted your life to creating more humane conditions for animals and more humane, pain-free ways of slaughtering them. Do you feel like you empathize with cattle?
Well, I know how cattle feel. And a lot of people, you know, when they think about the slaughter plan, all they can think about is, well, the cattle have got to know they're being slaughtered. Well, the things that scare the cattle are not the same things that we worry about. There's several slaughter plants in Colorado. I go, you know, visit them fairly often. And at one of them, the cattle don't like a little chain that's sometimes hanging down in the chute. They'll watch that little chain. I was at the plant one day and a train went rushing by. And the cattle were much more scared of the train than they were of going into the slaughter plant. You've got to have proper lighting. They won't go in if they can't see high-pitched noise. Sometimes just changing the plumbing on the hydraulic system to get rid of high-pitched noise will make the cattle go in much easier. It's easy for me to figure out how the cattle think because they think the way I do. In fact, the title of my book finally got made to be Thinking in Pictures. And that's the way animals think. They think in pictures.
Tell us about one of the designs you came up with for a more humane slaughterhouse.
Well, I've done a lot of work on putting in curved chute systems, and one of the reasons this works is because the cattle can't see people up ahead. They just sort of go round and round and round like the Guggenheim Museum. And then I designed a device called the Center Track Restrainer System, and it replaced older type conveyor systems and holds the cattle in a more comfortable manner, and they just follow through. They just keep following the animal in front of them, and they just go in there and they're shot, and they don't know what's happened.
When you're in a slaughterhouse, is the smell of blood and the sight of the cattle lining up on their way to slaughter, is that upsetting to you?
Well, if things are going right and they're just walking in calmly, it's not upsetting. You know, people forget nature's very harsh. I mean, when a lion rips apart an animal and just dines on it while the animal's still alive, that's not very nice for the animal. And you know, if I was an animal, I think I'd rather go to a decent slaughter plant than have a lion dine on me while I'm still alive.
You seem to really understand cattle and to be able to know what's going to disturb them and upset them. Do you feel you have the same insights about other people?
Well, you know, it's easy to figure out cattle because I think visually, and I my nervous system reacts the way cattle do. But there are a lot of, you know, social things that go on. I just had to learn by, you know, rote memory. I never realized how visual my thinking was until I started talking to other people about how they thought. I mean, I used to think everybody thought in videos, and now I found out that some people think in words and just sort of vague pictures. See, all of my thinking goes from specific to general. Like, for example, my concept of what a dog is not a generalized concept, but I see a whole bunch of pictures in my mind of very specific dogs. And I've actually, you know, tested people's visual thinking by saying, access your memory on church steeples. And I deliberately picked that because it's something that's not in the room that they can see. It's not something they have at home. And most people just see sort of a vague, generalized picture. I see only specific ones, starting with very specific childhood memories and then very specific ones I saw maybe yesterday or last week. And with specific to general thinking, you know, I have to just learn social skills by example. I have to learn social skills like a child would learn in school lessons. I'm sort of like a Data on Star Trek. In fact, I have a whole chapter in my new book on called Dating Data.
Right.
And when I was in high school, I mean, I just couldn't understand, you know, all why there was so much interest in things like jewelry and clothes. I mean, there was much more interesting stuff in Mr. Carlock's science lab.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Temple Grandin, and she's written a new autobiography called Thinking in Pictures and Other Reports from My Life with Autism. She is autistic. She is one of the nation's leading designers of restraints for cattle. She's very successful in that field. You understand cattle so well. What do you find very mysterious about other people?
Well, my emotions are not as complex. I have a difficult time understanding how somebody can be jealous and love somebody at the same time. I definitely have emotions, but fear is one of my main emotions. And of course, that's one of the main emotions of animals. They see a little chain or something jiggling, or they see a shadow looks out of place, they get a fear reaction. And I just don't, it just isn't part of my experience to like swoon over some guy because I think he's really cute. When I was in high school, my roommate would like practically faint on the floor when Bob, the science teacher, walked into the room. I mean, and she'd be swooning on the floor when she was watching the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. And I go, yeah, they're cute, but I'm not going to faint on the floor over it.
Do you understand love?
Well, I understand caring. And see, most of my relationships are more intellect. I have a number of friends that I think I've been able to help them out, you know, on some counseling sort of things. And to me, love is caring. In fact, my mother wrote one time that love was making something grow. I mean, that's sort of the way I look at it, but it's more of an intellectual thing. And when I see people abuse cattle, it makes me very angry. And, you know, and I want to, you know, change things.
Do you feel like you're missing out on something special by not being in love and not understanding that emotion?
I'm missing out on some things, but I also have talents that other people don't have. I don't want to give up visual thinking. In fact, Oliver Sacks asked me in his book, Anthropologist on Mars, if you could, you know, suddenly snap your fingers and not be autistic, would you do that? And no, I wouldn't, because I don't want to give up visual thinking. Visual thinking makes me a very clear thinking gives me very, very clear thinking in scientific and technical things. To me, a lot of the highly verbal thinkers are very fuzzy thinkers and they're not logical.
My guest is Temple Grandin. She's written a memoir about her life with autism called Thinking in Pictures. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Temple Grandin. She's autistic and has written a memoir called Thinking in Pictures. Children who are autistic often engage in very repetitive, obsessive behavior, like rocking back and forth or are spinning. You did some of that when you were young.
Very definitely. And the reason why autistic children engage in these behaviors is to block out stimuli that hurt. But the problem is, if you just let the child sit in a corner and rock, he's going to end up sitting in a corner and rocking for the rest of his life. I cannot emphasize enough the importance of getting a child very early, when they're 2 and 3 and 4 years old, into a really good program. Okay, what is a good program? You need to spend a lot of hours a day just keeping that child engaged with the world. In my case, I was very lucky, and my mother really worked hard to get me a good education. At 2 and a half, I went into a speech therapy nursery school where we had a very structured day, and I was not allowed to just tune out. And then meals were structured because I'm 48 years old, and I lived at a time when you sat at the table and we were taught manners. And then my mother had a nanny that would spend 2 or 3 hours a day with me just playing games, keeping me occupied so I couldn't tune out. But then on the other hand, you've got to protect these children from certain sounds that hurt, like a smoke alarm, certain telephones, the school bell. These sounds hurt like a dentist drill going down my ear. And I was scared to go into certain rooms because I didn't know when the bell was going to go off. And the children have got to be protected from these sounds. I had a mother call me up, and she told me her child was scared to death of church. He would go into the Sunday school, but he wouldn't go into the church. And the reason for this is that one day the microphone fed back and squealed, and that hurt the child's ears. And he was afraid to go in there because he was afraid it would happen again.
When you went to school as a girl, was it a public school?
I went to a small private school. You know, I had 2 years of really intensive treatment, and I was mainstreamed into a normal kindergarten at age 5. But it was a very old-fashioned, highly structured kindergarten. There was only 12 children in the class with an older, experienced teacher. There was no open classroom with kids running around doing all different sorts of things. Everybody did the same thing all at once.
Now, I want to get back to the idea of spinning, that kind of or rocking, that kind of obsessive behavior. You say that it helped you and helps a lot of like autistic people block out painful stimuli.
Well, it helps you block out painful stimuli. But the problem is, if you let the child do it all day, that's all they'll do. Autism is a neurological disorder. Research done by Margaret Bowman in Boston shows very clearly that there's immature development in the limbic system of the brain and in the cerebellum, which is involved with balance and with sensory modulation.
When I see somebody spinning or rocking obsessively, to me it looks like the behavior of someone who's incredibly frustrated and unhappy. Was there any sense of frustration when you would be rocking?
Well, actually, once I got rocking, it was almost like taking a drug. I mean, I would just, I used to like to rock. I also used to like to just sit and dribble sand through my hands, and it was just like getting high on something. And I would just be completely tuned out. See, when you have senses that hurt, you have two choices. You can let the whole world come in and just blast you out, or you can sit and rock and shut everything out. And then you get addicted to rocking. It's just like taking an addictive drug. And there's some evidence in animals that there is actually an addiction. Endorphins get released, which are the brain's own natural, opioids. And you can get addicted to the behavior. But I wouldn't be here now if I'd been allowed to sit in a corner and rock for 8 hours a day.
What was the best way and what was the worst way that an adult could approach you to get you to stop rocking?
Well, the worst thing you can do is cause too much sensory stimulation. Now, there's different levels of autism. I had sensory sensitivities, but I did not have the kind of problems where seeing and hearing were actually mixing together. You did an interview a while back with Donna Williams, and she described being mono-channel. In other words, she couldn't see and hear at the same time. My problems weren't as severe. So as long as I was in a reasonably quiet room, the teacher could kind of just say, now, come on, you just pay attention. She could literally snap me out of it. where a child that's like Donna Williams, that's not going to work. In fact, Donna told me that if somebody had grabbed her chin and tried to force her to pay attention, she would just go into sensory shutdown and nothing would get through. With her, you have to take a much more gentle approach, maybe get a darkened room, and just work with singing very softly, so that only one sensory channel is used very gently at a time.
Did you ever experience what she describes as that kind of sensory shutdown, the shutdown of her whole system?
No, I did not. You see, her sensory problems are more severe than mine are. Both Donna and I are both very intelligent people. I want to make it very clear this has nothing to do with mental retardation. This has to do with sensory processing. And even in my own case, I have problems with understanding complex speech sounds. I think one of the things we need to be looking at a lot more carefully in these children is, can they understand complex speech? You can pass a pure tone hearing test, and that doesn't tell you anything about your ability to understand complex speech. And I have problems with mixing up different consonant sounds. I have to figure out words by context. Last year, I had a new research hearing test where they tested my ability to understand complex sounds and process complex sounds, and I mixed up things like workshop and woodchuck. Now, if I was out working with one of my meat clients, I'd know that they weren't talking about the woodchuck. If we were down in the maintenance shop, they'd be talking about the workshop. So I'm able to figure it out by context.
When did you realize that you were different from most other people?
Well, as a little kid, I had a really odd lack of awareness that I was different. And even on my visual thinking, I mean, I was an adult before I realized that other people did not have the extensive visual thinking that I had. And I'd go out on a job where we'd be designing equipment, and I'd go, how could the engineers be so stupid? Wouldn't they know that's not going to work? Well, I just assumed everybody had visual thinking. You know, now when I've like carefully interviewed people about how they think, I've realized it's not stupidity that caused them to design it wrong. They simply don't have visual thinking. I mean, some engineers definitely do have it. There are non-autistic people that have visual thinking, but there's also some people out there that have very limited visual thinking.
How do you live now? Do you live alone?
Yeah, I just live by myself. Basically, my work is my life. Uh-huh. And that's true for other successful autistic adults. There's some other autistic adults that, doing well in jobs. One of the best kind of job is freelance work. I do all my work freelance. I can go into a plant, get the system designed, and get out of there before I get into some hassle with the people there. There's a lady that I know is autistic that does computer programming on industrial computers that run equipment in factories such as breweries. She goes in, she does the job, she gets out. Both of us have developed an expertise in a very specialized area. And an autistic person has to sell their work rather than themselves. I recommend to other autistic people, develop a talent and then make a portfolio of your work, because you're going to have to bypass the personnel office and show it right to the art department or the computer department.
Are people ever reluctant to work with you because you are autistic?
Well, in the beginning, they really thought I was really nerdy. And I remember one time being in an agricultural engineering meeting, and they thought I was really, weird. And then I pulled out a drawing that I had done of a cattle handling facility, and the engineers went, "You drew that?" They just couldn't believe that, this weird nerd could draw such a nice drawing. But as soon as they saw the drawing and they saw how nice it was, then they started having a different attitude towards me.
Do you feel that as time goes by, you're becoming less autistic?
Well, you keep learning how to get more and more normal. It's sort of like Data on Star Trek. Data keeps trying to learn more about how people act. And I remember watching a Star Trek, and I wish I could remember the name of the episode, but Data was trying to date a girl. And it was a total disaster because he told her that she was beautiful in scientific terms, like saying, you have a lovely, smooth epidermis. Well, that just doesn't work.
So you identify with him?
Oh, I definitely identify with him, and I identified with Mr. Spock.
My understanding is that most people who are autistic like repetition, familiarity, patterns, systems. You travel a lot. You do a lot of public speaking. You do a lot of freelance work, so you're working for different people. It's amazing to me that you can do that. Are you not upset by change?
Well, you know, you've been in one Holiday Inn, you've been in them all. In fact, they're starting to standardize the beds now, and I really do like that. It seems like all the hotels now put these thick quilted spreads on, and I really like that. You know, you get so used to airports, they're not different. But it does make me nervous to do some different mode of travel. I don't travel by train very much, and trains make me nervous because I haven't been on them enough to get completely familiar with them.
Donna Williams, who is also autistic and wrote a couple of books about that, you've met her, you've spoken with her. What was it like for you to meet her? I mean, do you know a lot of other autistic people who, like you, can, you know, speak and write and function at this really high level?
I didn't actually get a chance to meet Donna. I've had some long telephone conversations with her, and those went really well because, again, that's mono channel. All she had to do was listen. In fact, I think the phone conversations are probably better than meeting her, because we could just talk, you know, normally, and she didn't have the visual distractions. I know a lot of other autistic people. I see them at the meetings, and one of the biggest problems is getting jobs. There's people out there with college degrees and with PhDs, and they don't have any job. And the ones that are successful are doing, you know, freelance work in a highly specialized, usually either a technical area or art or graphic arts. Another area that's good because of the visual thinking is things like small engine repair and automobile repair.
Judging from our conversation, it's you're a very good speaker. Is it as easy for you to write?
I can write. Because I have an associational mind, I have problems with organization. And Betsy Lerner, my editor, I really owe a big gratitude to her ripping her hair out on my organization. Because I think associational. Like, for example, I have a thing in my book where I copied a sentence out of a magazine that described the Olympics. And it said something like, all the elements were in place, the waltzes and the little sprites jumping in the air. And that was talking about skating. Now, if I just read that whole thing, I get a picture of the skating arena. But if I stop on the word elements, then I get an association back to the periodic chart of the elements in my high school classroom. If I look at the word sprite, I get pictures of sprite cans in my refrigerator, sprite cans at the store where I buy gas. Now I go to an association of putting gas in my car at one convenience market and then putting gas in my car at another convenience store. That's how the associational mind works. And Betsy ripped her hair out on organization, and we got things organized. And if I ever do another book, I'm going to know how to prevent this problem by making a very, very good outline. And then each little part of the outline will just be two pages of the book. I mean, I'm not going to, if I ever do another book, I won't put Betsy through all of that again. Because I learned a lot about organization writing it. Because all my scientific papers, I don't have a problem, because scientific papers aren't that long. And scientific papers have a very big structure. You do an introduction, you do your methods, you do your results, and then you do your discussion, and then there's a summary.
Now, the association didn't, you know, the associative thinking didn't seem to be a problem in this interview. You stayed right on the subject all the time.
Well, because it isn't that long. You see, writing, doing the interview is more like doing a scientific paper. It isn't like doing a whole great big gigantic book.
Right.
But I just want to tell all the readers out there, I mean, I've got decent organization in my book now, and I really can thank Betsy, my editor.
I'll concur. It's very well organized. It's a very good book, and I want to congratulate you on it. And thank you very, very much. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been just great to talk with you.
Temple Grandin, her memoir is called Thinking in Pictures and Other Reports from My Life with Autism. This is Fresh Air. The Great White Hype is a new comedy starring Samuel Jackson as boxing promoter Reverend Fred Salton. The film is directed by Reginald Hudlin, who along with his brother made House Party. Commentator Gerald Early has written about boxing. He's the author of The Culture of Bruising. Gerald went to see the film, liked it, and thought Hudlin did a good job parodying real-life promoter Don King.
Jose Torres, former boxing champion and writer, once said that boxing is about deception. What he meant was that boxers with their feints and moves wish to fool each other. Boxing is about conning your opponent into moving in a way so that he can be defeated. But professional boxing has also been about deception of another sort. Because the sport was invented by gamblers in 18th century England, and gamblers want a sure thing, there has always been dishonesty associated with boxing matches themselves. Did Muhammad Ali really hit Sonny Liston with a phantom punch? With odds at 40-1 against Buster Douglas, was his victory over Mike Tyson legit, or did some gamblers decide to make a killing? And what about pathetic Primo Cannera, the inept Italian heavyweight who, through rigged matches, actually was champion from 1933 to 1934? His rise and fall was the basis of both the novel and film, The Harder They Fall. There's always been an element of the long con in many boxing matches. Boxing is the sport, more than any other, that symbolizes the dirty aspects of laissez-faire capitalism, the dog-eat-dog mentality, the wolfish wish by the power brokers absolutely to fix the market, use up their human resource, and soak the public. And among the most colorful and ruthless of the gamblers or venture capitalists associated with boxing have been the promoters. Reginald Hudlin's latest film, The Great White Hype, is a satire about the most colorful and ruthless promoter on the scene today, Don King. Like the film's Fred Salton, played by Samuel L. Jackson, Don King, on the surface, is a broad, nearly comic parody of the huckster, seemingly an American Falstaff. But beneath this Runyon-esque facade is a cold, calculating, cruel man. Salton, like King, stomped a man to death for a debt and served time in prison for manslaughter. King was a big-time numbers runner in Cleveland, a city that figures importantly in Hudlin's film. When King emerged from prison, he reinvented himself as a boxing promoter, although he knew nothing about the sport. Within 3 years, he helped promote one of the biggest prize fights in history, Muhammad Ali versus George Foreman in Zaire. In 1977, he presented a rigged boxing tournament on network TV. King has been investigated by the FBI, tried for tax evasion, sued by fighters he has never paid, and has always managed to come out on top. In the film, Salton's favorite phrase is, "God bless America." King's motto is, "Only in America," referring to his rise to fame and fortune. But Hudlin is interested in more than just a con man promoter. For Hudlin, boxing is a tribal sport about racial identification with the men in the ring. Salton, the promoter, convinces the public and even the film's audience that a white amateur fighter who hasn't fought in 10 years can beat a very talented black heavyweight champion. The film satirically critiques the racism of the Rocky movies by showing how race is used to sell an image. But the film is also about integrity and selling out. Even people who seem to have principles can be bought by the great Salton. The horror of boxing for Hudlin is how everyone, Salton, the casino owner, and both the white and black public, use the fighters for their own needs as instruments to fulfill their greed and their sick fantasies. I like this film because, like Mark Twain's fiction, it powerfully shows the dark side of the American dream.
Gerald Early teaches literature at Washington University, where he directs the African and Afro-American Studies Department. He's the author of The Culture of Bruising, essays on prize fighting, literature, and modern American culture. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Kathy Wolf, Joan Tui Westman, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, a concert and interview with pianist Peter Minton. He'll sing and play some wonderful but forgotten songs of the 20s and 30s. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.